court is now ready to hear argument in Henry S. Miller Company versus Bynum. Each side has been allotted 15 minutes to present oral argument, and we are ready to hear from petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Wallace will present argument for petitioners. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Please, the court, I'm Jim Wallace from Austin, and I'd like to introduce co-counsel Joe Klobuchek from Houston. Petition is granted on one point, and the facts pertinent to that point are quite simple. The interrogatories was propounded by the defendant to the plaintiff. The plaintiff failed to answer. Subsequent to that, pursuant to the trial court order, a joint pretrial order was filed without the assistance of the plaintiff because the plaintiff refused to submit the information requested the defendant so he could file it. So the defendant filed that pretrial order listing only his information. The defendant then filed a motion for sanctions to compel answer to his interrogatories. The trial court declined to enter sanctions but instructed the plaintiff to answer interrogatories. The plaintiff still didn't answer interrogatories. Subsequently, the plaintiff was deposed, and then the case went to trial. At the time that the plaintiff's attorney called his client as a witness, objections were properly made to his appearing inasmuch as he had not been listed as a person with knowledge of relevant facts. Each of you have before you the pertinent copies, pages of the statement of facts, giving the dialogue between the trial court and plaintiff's attorney. The trial court properly ruled that the plaintiff could not testify as an expert, and yet, for some reason we can mostly have to guess about, the trial court said he would let the plaintiff testify as a fact witness. At one time in that dialogue, he did mention that he was a party witness. The trial court ruled that he would not be able to testify as an expert, testify the fact witness, and then later on, if he got into expert matters, and the court would look at the interrogatories and make a decision at that time. That did happen, and later on, some 70 pages later in the statement of fact, when Mr. Bynum was offered as an expert witness, the trial court very clearly ruled that there was no good cause shown for failure to list him as a witness, and refused to let him testify.
Mr. Wallace, did your client have any clue at all that the plaintiff was going to testify?
No, sir. And I'll tell
you why. Did he not anticipate that the plaintiff who brought the action and who was going to testify in his own lawsuit?
Your Honor, a jury fee had been paid in this case. No fact witness had been testified, had been listed as people with knowledge of relevant facts. The plaintiff knew that Bynum was the plaintiff. The plaintiff had deposed Bynum. He knew what he would say had he been permitted to testify. This court in Alvarado, well, first in Sharp, and then in Alvarado, the Judge Eck mentioned again that a party is entitled to go to court expecting testimony from those witnesses who have been listed with knowledge of relevant facts. The jury fee was waived in this case and was tried before the court, which is pretty good indication that defendant did not expect the plaintiff to testify because the plaintiff had not been listed as a party. And that's the reason I answered Judge Gonzalez. Since the trial court clearly found no good cause, then we don't get into the question of whether or not the trial court abused his discretion in letting him testify. Nothing was said by either Bynum's attorney or the trial court any further as to him testifying as fact witness. No good cause was shown for that other than what was shown as an expert. Now, logically and reasonably, there is no difference between the qualifications of the witness, whether it's expert or fact, listing or don't talk. So, since good cause, the court said, was not found, we don't get into the question of exercise of discretion. And if we did, this court has on about, I believe, 11 times in the last 6 or 7 years now, said that knowledge that the plaintiff, the party, knowledge of what the party would testify to, the fact that the party witness had been deposed is not good cause. And so even if the trial court had attempted to use that and found good cause, this court says that is not good cause, and we have a law question, not a fact question, over which the trial court could exercise its discretion. So we get down to the only other possible reason that the trial court let Mr. Bynum testify as a fact witness, and that is that he was a party. Now, Rule 166B, 2D, and Rule 215.5 are the pertinent rules here. Rule 215 very clearly states that a party cannot testify if he had not been named in answer to interrogatories. The plaintiff, Mr. Bynum, in this case, in his brief, pretty much argued what he had argued for the trial court, deposition and knowledge that he was going to be a plaintiff, and as a matter of fact, that his name was on the petition, was noticed that he was going to be a witness. The amicus brief gets into trying to distinguish between the trying to find ground in the wording of the statute, which says that if the party is not named, he cannot be called, where it refers to the opposing party or other persons. And that he attempted to construe that in such a way that other persons referred back to the party himself instead of two expert witnesses that it set out in the rule. That's like saying, for instance, well, John and Mary Brown went on a vacation to Hawaii. They met a very nice couple from Dallas and other persons. Arguing, well, that other person referred back to John and Mary Brown instead of to the nice couple they met from Dallas. The rules of grammatical construction says that when you have a qualifying phrase, it relates back to the nearest phrase to it. I don't think any sort of grammatical construction that the court can put on those rules will say that when you talk about other persons, they're referring to persons other than the party himself. The reason that we're here today, really, is because this court attempt to make clear to the bench and bar that discovery is important, that we're going to conduct discovery in a sensible, reasonable manner, and do it according to the rules. The court has gone beyond and above the call of duty, and writing on this question, I said you've issued, I believe, 11 opinions over the past 7 years discussing this question of who can be called as a witness if they're not listed in answer to interrogatories.
Mr. Wallace, the result you urge here make any sense apart from the advantage of having a bright line test to discourage unnecessary litigation or uncertainty in future cases? In other words, does it make any sense in this particular case? Is there any justice or fairness in a party essentially losing their rights because of this oversight?
Your Honor, this is the same thing as the fact if you don't file an answer, you suffer a default judgment.
But there's plenty of ways out of that.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the court has developed in most areas some rather lengthy tests that can let one out of the effects of one's own mistake.
Well,
and here we have good cause.
Here is good cause. And if there is a legitimate good cause, but if you go back and
the Court of Appeals, in their opinion, says that the trial court implicitly found good cause by allowing the testimony.
Well, the trial court, and I'm mystified by the opinion personally, because the trial court said, well, the court could have done so and so. They could have found that the court could have taken notice of the fact that he gave a deposition, and he could have taken notice that he was a party. And that's all. And then on the party part, the Court of Appeals never gave a real reason for their opinion. They said, we don't find any abuse of discretion. The court might have done so and so and might have done so and so. But they never gave a clear-cut basis at all for what they did.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Bishop will present the argument for respondent.
Your Honors, I'm George Bishop from Houston, and I'm here with my co-counsel Joseph Nixon from Houston and Mr. Otto Hewitt from Galveston, who filed the amicus brief. When I first started practicing law in 1966, we had what was called trial by ambush. I remember when I was in law school at the University of Texas reading a case by this court back in the 50s, which held that when a bus company had an accident and the bus driver went through the bus and took down the names of every passenger, that that was not discoverable by the other person that the bus had hit. In other words, those names of witnesses were considered work products. The purpose of the rules of civil procedure are really to ensure a fair trial. One of the few rules that's never been amended is Rule 1, which has been in effect since September 1st, 1941, which states their purpose is to give a fair and just trial. It's true, as Judge Wallace says, the answers to interrogatories were not provided. The interrogatories were sent on November 4th, 1987, and shortly after that, a three-day deposition of Dr. Bynum was commenced on November 18th, in which the information that is sought in the interrogatories, which is specifically interrogatory number 4, what is the name, address, and phone number of any witnesses that have knowledge, was asked in the very first question, what's your name, what's your address, and that was given, and then 3 days later, the deposition was terminated. At no time during the trial was it ever contended that he said something on his deposition that was any different than what he had said at trial. At no time was it ever contended by any of the defendants that there was some document that was produced at trial that wasn't produced at the deposition. I do want to talk about those rules specifically because I think some of the things that Judge Wallace said are incorrect. First of all, there was no motion to compel answers to these interrogatories. The file, as you will see, shows that there was no such motion. What would happen if Judge Wallace's position were to prevail was that instead of having trial by ambush, as we had when I first started practicing law, we would have trial by gotcha. He says, well, his client waived the jury. Well, my clients waived the jury. This court well knows once the jury fee is paid, both or all parties have to agree. In fact, the third-party defendant waived the jury. All parties agreed to waive the jury and try the case non-jury. That had nothing to do with the issues in the case. It had nothing to do with the outcome. No one is contending they were in some way sandbagged because everybody to this lawsuit waived the jury. But apparently, what Judge Wallace would have us believe is that, in fact, his clients waived the jury because they were going to then say, we got you, because Dr. Bynum can't testify because you didn't put his name down on the answer to interrogatory number 4. Let me, if I may, very briefly, just read that question.
Mr. Bishop,
yes, Your Honor.
Before you get to that, let me ask you, you represent Starfire Engineering Incorporated as well?
I do.
And if Starfire Engineering Incorporated had been the only party in the lawsuit, what witnesses would you have been entitled to call?
If Starfire Engineering had been the only party, I think probably they would not have been able to call any expert or fact witnesses based on this court's rulings in other cases.
But you're saying, aren't you, that since Mr. Bynum was a party to the lawsuit, that's somehow excluded from the automatic exclusion of that testimony under Rule 215.5. Why wouldn't that apply to a corporate party?
Well, Your Honor, I said what I said. But as this court well knows, every corporation has the right to have a representative. The rules don't really speak to whether that representative is a party or not, but I know that they're excluded from the rule where parties are required, other than parties are required to stay outside the courtroom, for instance. So I think, one, perhaps, in fact, a corporation could have a representative, a party, that could appear, even if his answer were not, even if his name was not in the answer's interrogatory.
I
think a party itself could.
How would the opposing party know who that individual would be,
well,
other than at the time they appeared in the courtroom and were designated as a corporate representative?
I suppose that could be asked on interrogatories also.
But if, as here, the interrogatories were not answered, how would that information come to the opposing party?
They wouldn't know unless they answered by some, unless they inquired by some other means of discovery. But that is an excellent question, and it's a question that no court apparently has addressed in this state, other than the dissenting opinion in the First Court of Appeals has addressed that to some extent.
So you agree that then that if we accept parties from the requirements of the rule, it'll have to apply to corporate and governmental parties as well as individual parties?
Well, again, because of the fact that a corporation has the right to designate someone to be the person in the courtroom for them, there may be some exception, but frankly, I don't know. I think clearly a party can. I don't know whether a party can that's a person that is representing a corporation as a party, because I have not addressed that in our brief. The amicus has not addressed that.
Isn't it the logical result if you create an exception for parties having to justify discriminating against corporate parties, partnership parties, and governmental parties, and treating individual parties differently?
I don't see how you could, Your Honor.
And so if you do that, don't you get right back to trial by ambush and allow General Motors to have their corporate representative available to fill any gaps that they've overlooked in the presentation of their case?
I don't think that
would
be the correct answer to that, Your Honor. I don't think that's a trial by ambush when, in fact, perhaps in General Motors' instance, they knew who it was. They'd taken his deposition for 3 days. They'd ask him every question. There was never any contention.
Do I understand that the exception you're looking for then is not an exception for parties, but an exception for parties whose depositions have been taken and all the other things that you just mentioned?
No, sir. What I am saying, Your Honor, is that, one, I think the way the rule is written gives an exception. The way the rules are written give an exception for a party. I think the rules as they are written, particularly 215 subsection 5, refers to other parties. I know that since, I think, January 1940, this court has had committees that study these rules and study, in fact, every word of these rules. And then the court itself studies those rules before they're published. And in fact, then they have the effect of a statute, as this court has held in several cases. The actual wording of 215.5 says, refers to other party. The word other must be in there for some purpose. And when you say that it would apply to an individual, and perhaps not to a corporation, I don't know the answer to that question, but I think if you look at the rule itself, you have wording that I believe in plain English and in grammar does not apply to a specific party. Perhaps when the new rules committee meets, they can make some exception or not for corporations for partnerships. But I think the reason I mentioned the fact about the deposition is because I think that goes to the good cause part of our argument. Good cause being, in fact, that they took his deposition, that they knew who this party was.
Well, if we go down that trail, then don't we have to apply that in any case, whether it's a party or not a party? That good cause will be available if a deposition's been taken and there's no need to listen to them to interrogatory answers anymore?
No, sir. I think, as this court has held once before, the mere taking of a deposition does not constitute good cause. I've been unable to find a case that says what constitutes good cause out of this particular court. But the rule says good cause is to be determined by the trial court. And as this court well knows, that can only be set aside on the basis of an abuse of discretion. But in this case, we have something besides taking his deposition. Well, we have the fact that he was a party.
Well, then you basically are saying that a party plus the taking of the party's deposition equals good cause, but a non-party in the taking of a deposition does not equal good cause.
I think you've hit something that I do want to talk about. The fact that the man was a party means that they could not talk to him. They could not call him up and ask him what he was going to say. But if he was somebody that witnessed this and did not have a lawyer and was not a party, then they could call him. That's why I think the rule refers to other persons. And if it's a person that works for a corporation and he's not designated as the representative of that corporation, I believe they could talk to that person, unless he's designated as the representative of the corporation in that case. And the difference here is Dr. Bynum had a lawyer. They couldn't call him and talk to him. They contacted me within a couple of days after they sent out the interrogatories and asked to take his deposition. We produced him before the interrogatories were even due to be answered, and he testified for 3 days. Now, I think that, and as well as the other things here, would show good cause. But I think there are two different really subjects to your question. One is, how is the rule to be interpreted? And the way it's written now, I think it's to be interpreted, it talks about other persons. And secondly, is there good cause, as Judge Powell implicitly found when he let him testify as a fact witness, and then 70 pages later, when we asked to call him as an expert witness, he determined there was not good cause to call him as an expert witness, although there had been to call him as a fact witness, since they knew what he was going to say and they knew he was involved in the case from the beginning, so forth.
But they knew what he was going to say as an expert, too, didn't they?
Excuse me, sir?
They knew what he was going to say as an expert.
They also knew that.
So how do you explain the trial court's ruling?
The only way I can explain the trial court's ruling, Your Honor, is the fact that perhaps he felt like a more stringent test would be required in order to have someone testify as an expert witness, because, for instance, the interrogatory number 4 is one we're talking about as far as fact witness, but the other 4 interrogatories are a total of 5, all deal with what he did as an expert, if anybody was, what he was going to testify about, the purpose, the basis of his mental impressions, his opinions, and so forth. None of those were answered either, so I think that's the difference, because they had asked for mental impressions as far as an expert, but they had not asked for contentions as far as a fact witness. I think that's perhaps the explanation. I would say it is a difficult case. This is a case that's important to probably every trial lawyer in the state, but I think the purpose of our rules are to allow a fair trial, to allow notice. I think this did in fact occur in this case, and if you read the rules and you use proper English construction, I think that the court can see that the rule does not specifically apply to a party who's going to testify as a fact witness, and if it does, Judge Powell found good cause that should not be reversed by this court, because I don't believe they have shown an abuse of discretion on behalf of Judge Powell.
Under the rule, then, if there are 50 parties in a land dispute, none of them have to be designated as to which one's going to carry the laboring oar in testifying at the trial.
Your Honor, each party, I believe, can call that party, even if they have not listed them in the answer to an interrogatory such as this, but they could not call another party on the same side, but under Rule 181, they could call an opposing party. Because Rule 181 gives them the privilege of calling an opposing party, and I think that privilege applies whether they've listed them or not. So if there are 50 parties and they're opposing, they could, I believe, under Rule 181, call any of those. But they could not call a party on the same side in which they listed them, because that party would be a witness.
So the rule you propose is that there not only can a litigant, say a lawyer who represents a party, call that party, they can call the opposing party to testify, or as many as there may be, without answering any interrogatories.
Well, Your Honor, I don't propose this rule. I say that under Rule 181 and under Rule 215.5, that can be done at this point. And I'm asking that the court affirm the trial court and the Court of Appeals based on that. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, just carry forward a little bit some of the questions you were throwing at Mr. Bishop. It is not unusual at all to find multiple corporate parties on one side of a lawsuit, all of which are interrelated, all of which are being controlled by the same group of people. Now, you have a situation where four or five different subsidiaries of the main defendant are all listed as parties. Under Mr. Bishop's scenario, each one of those can designate the representative at trial, which they don't have to do until the trial starts. They cannot be subjected to the rule. So you could easily have four, five, or six key witnesses, which have been hidden up to that time, sitting there, listening to the evidence, sizing up what's selling to the jury and whatnot, and then call to really ambush the other side.
Mr. Wallace, do you think that Rule 1 ever has any application in ameliorating the literal text of a rule?
No, sir, I don't. And
what is its purpose then?
Just to give the overall tenure of the approach.
That's kind of like we the people and kind of like we the people in the Constitution.
Yes, sir. And then the court had promulgated specific rules for specific phases of the trial.
Does this case remind you a little bit of Alexander versus Hagedorn?
Yes, sir. But
didn't it take the court a long time to get over Alexander versus Hagedorn?
Yes, sir. But look, what I would like to focus on just these couple of minutes is the bag of worms the court would be getting into if you went along with Mr. Bishop. Let's take a super next friend. Who's going to be the party who can testify without having been named? A suit by a guardian. And as Judge Doggett mentioned, a suit by a public entity. This court, over a period of 7 years, has written more opinions on one point of law than I have ever seen at any time in the past. I'm not a Supreme Court historian, but I don't think you can go back to 1836 and find that the court has written 11 opinions on one point of law in 7 years. If this exception is made, you're going to be inundated with applications. For those 11 cases, I'm sure the court denied at least 100 applications.
So we will not have 11 more opinions following this one. You want to give us your definition of how we can define good cause while we're at it, so we will settle everything?
I can give you I suggest the rule be very simple. If you don't name him, you don't call him. Now, I think
why do we have a good cause requirement then in the rule? Is that just dead letter?
Well,
Rule 1.
No one has shown good cause yet. The court has said in
short. Said what it's not, but we haven't said what it did.
It's not being surprised.
Well, I know that.
All those things.
We've enumerated what it is not, but we have not said what it is. I'm asking for guidance and help.
I suppose good cause would be if the other side agreed that they didn't have to answer any interrogatories, that he knows the person is going to be called. If he had a written agreement under Rule 11, that would be good cause for calling him. I should think it would be rare, and it should be rare.
That'd have to be a Rule 11 agreement, I guess.
Yes, sir. This rule is a good rule. It has a good purpose, and the vast majority of the lawyers and the bench know the rule and follow it. If you look back on these cases that you have written on and those applications submitted, each time it's been because a lawyer was either careless or he didn't know what he was doing or just didn't bother with doing it. There's not anything in the world this court can do by promulgating rules or anything else that's going to cover up that sort of conduct. With 53,000 or so lawyers in the state of Texas, it's going to happen. But that doesn't mean the court has to sit here and try to fashion exceptions to its rules in order to cover that conduct. It's those people who have been careless and who didn't take care of their business and didn't answer the interrogatories, they're the ones with the responsibility of doing just that. The respect that the court, reverse court, the opinion of the Court of Appeals and the trial court, and any judgment of the petition.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the oral submissions for the day. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.